असतो मा सद्गमय,
ओम असतो मा सद्गमय,
तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय,
तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय,
मृत्योर्मा अमृतं गमय,
मृत्योर्मा अमृतं गमय,
ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः,
ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः,
त्वमेव माता च पिता त्वमेव,
त्वमेव माता च पिता त्वमेव,
त्वमेव बन्धुश्च सखा त्वमेव,
त्वमेव बन्धुश्च सखा त्वमेव,
त्वमेव विद्या द्रविणं त्वमेव,
त्वमेव विद्या द्रविणं त्वमेव,
त्वमेव सर्वं मम देव देव,
त्वमेव सर्वं मम देव देव,
गुरुर्ब्रह्मा गुरुर्विष्णुः गुरुर्देवो महेश्वरः गुरुस्साक्षात् परब्रह्म तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः, कस्तूरितिलकं ललाटपटले वक्षस्थले कौस्तुभम् नासाग्रे वरमौक्तिकम् करतले वेणुः करे कङ्कणम् सर्वाङ्गं हरिचन्दनम् सुललितं कण्ठे च मुक्तावली गोपस्त्री परिवेष्टितो विजयते गोपालचूडामणिः अस्ति स्वस्तरुणी कराग्रविगलत् कल्पप्रसूनाप्लुतम् वस्तु प्रस्तुत वेणुनादलहरी निर्वाण निर्व्याकुलम् स्रस्तस्रत्स्त निबद्ध नीवि विलसत् गोपी सहस्रावृतम् हस्तन्यस्तन तापवर्गमखिलोदारम् किशोराकृति सो टुडे वी विल कवर ध्रुव चरित्रम द स्टोरी ऑफ ध्रुवा whom we will see as a 5-year-old, okay? And this story of Dhruva occurs in the 4th skandham and spans 8th, 9th and 10th chapters. It runs over 3 chapters. And just before the story of Dhruva, a short introduction is given about the other branches of families that came from the Srishti. So interestingly, for whatever reason, before the Dhruva Charitram, the parampara of Adharma is mentioned. Okay, so Adharma has a wife called Mrsha. Mrsha means lie, untruth. Okay, Adharma is married to Mrsha. And then they have a son and a daughter. The son is called Dambha. And Dambha means show off. And it also means cheating others. Because when you show off, you are actually saying something which you don't have. So show off. And the daughter is called Maya. Okay. And these are mentioned in the Bhagavatam, so I'm just repeating as it is. So Dambham and Maya marry each other. okay, and they have lobha, lobhan. Here lobha is mentioned as masculine. Normally lobha is also given as feminine. So lobha is greed. So the children that Dambha and Maya have, the lobha and Nikriti. Nikriti is a daughter, and the meaning of Nikriti is again to be deceptive. Okay, so Nikriti and Lobha, and they marry each other, and then they have a son called Krodha. Krodha means anger. Okay, and then they have a daughter called Himsa. Himsa means violence. Okay, so this is the Adharma Parampara. Okay, so we have to understand all this symbolically, because all these are negative qualities, and it is just a way of saying what begins from where. And we have something very similar in Bhagavad Gita in the second or third chapter. Dhyayato Vishayan Pumsaha Sangas Teshu Pajayate Sangat Sanjayate Kamaha Kamat Krodho Vila Jayate, and all that. So Kama gives rise to Krodha. That is given in Bhagavad Gita also. So these are actually to be taken as symbolic representation. So what comes from what? Yeah. And then Himsa and Krodha, they marry, and to them is born Kali. And we saw Kali Purusha in the first and second day lectures. So Kali is actually an embodiment of all of this. So like we say that we inherit the qualities of all our ancestors. So Kali is the final product, and he has all these qualities of untruthfulness and maya, or cheating or deception, and anger and greed and violence. So this is just a pictorial or symbolic representation of Kali and all the negatives. And Kali has a sister, Durukti. Durukti means bad words, abusive words. Durukti is the sister. And then again they marry, and then they have a son called Yadan. Yada is a girl. Yada means extreme pain. Yada means extreme pain, torture. Okay? And then the son is called Nirayam. Nirayam is Narakam actually. Nirayam means hell. Okay? So, there this samparampara ends. Thankfully, it doesn't go further. Okay? So, this is a complete depiction of Adharma. And finally, it says, by knowing this history, you acquire punyam. Okay, and why you acquire punyam? Because you know this is bad and you avoid it, and thereby you acquire punyam. So by knowing the negatives and by avoiding the negatives, you acquire punyam. So that is the preamble to Dhruva's history. Now we will go into the Dhruva's charitram proper. Okay, so this is the first six shlokas of the eighth chapter of fourth skanda. Then the Vamsha of Swayambhu Manu begins. Now Swayambhu Manu is the direct son of Brahmaji. So when Brahmaji begins Srishti, he creates a lot of his own sons. And the first few sons are all rishis. So we had the Sanakadi rishis, who were the very first progenies. They did not enter family life. They took direct sannyasa. And then the Saptarishis came, and the Saptarishis are actually Grihasthas, but they are of Brahmana variety. So they are Brahmana Varnas. And then he produces a lot of Kshatriya Vamshas also, and the Manus that we see are all Kshatriyas. Swayambhu Manu, and we have a lot of, Swayambhu Manu. Vaivasvata Manu is one of the later Manus. So we are seeing about this Swayambhu Manu. Swayambhu Manu is the first Manu. And I think I mentioned in the first day lecture, Brahmaji's one day, calendar day, consists of 2000 Chaturyugas. And this 2000 Chaturyugas is divided into 14 parts. And these 14 parts are respectively governed by 14 different Manus. So each Manu has the ruler role for the first 71 Chaturyugas. So in that list, Swayambhu Manu has the first place. He is the first Manu who takes care of the first 71 Chaturyugas. And Dhruva comes in his parampara. Okay. So Swayambhu has a wife whose name is Shatarupa. And Shatarupa is also a very interesting name. It means she's got 100 different forms. She can present herself as 100 different forms. And in some other parts of the Purana where the creation is given in detail, you will see that every species that we have on this earth, everything comes from Manu and Shatarupa. So Manu and Shatarupa, even though they are described here in human forms, more or less, they give rise to even all the animals and plants and everything. So the creation starts from a couple who give rise to all the animals and human beings and even devas. So Manu, the Swayambhu Manu is the Swayambhu Manu and Shatarupa are the parents of even devas. And some of the devas are also born out of rishis, like Kashyapa and all those people. So it is a very symbolic representation of creation, because creation happens at multiple levels. Yeah. And this Swayambhu Manu has two sons. There is one Virata and there is a Uttanapada. Okay? And it is mentioned here that both of them are Amshas of Narayana, Lord Narayana himself. Okay. And we don't have much details about Virata, but it is Uttanapada who is the father of Dhruva. Okay, so Uttanapada has two wives. Uttanapada's first wife is Suniti and the second wife is Suruchi. And Dhruva is the son of Suniti and the son of Suruchi is called Ananda. Okay, we will go into the interpretation of these names a little later at the end of the story. Right now, let's run through the story. Yeah. So, Uttanapada is a king. And this story now happens when Dhruva is about approximately 5 years old. And Ananda is probably the same age or slightly younger, because he's supposed to be a younger brother. And this king Uttanapada doesn't like Suniti. His favorite wife is Suruchi. And so Dhruva gets a stepmotherly treatment from Suruchi. And Suniti is kind of consigned to the back end of the palace. She is not coming to the court and she doesn't sit next to the king. All that respect and glory is reserved for Suruchi. So when the king is sitting in the court, Suruchi is next to him. And this boy, Ananda, is playing on the lap of Uttanapada. Because favorite wife, favorite son. So the boy, Ananda, is playing on the lap of Uttanapada. And at that time, the five-year-old Dhruva also happens to come to the court. And he wants to play with his father also. Because, it's his father also. And sibling rivalry or whatever. So he also wants a place on the king's lap. And he tries to get onto the king's lap. At that time, the Suruchi chides him and maybe she pushes him also. And he says, you don't have any qualification to sit on the king's lap because you are not born in my womb. So if you want to play with the king, you should have been born in my womb. So you don't have the qualifications. You get out. If you want to, have this privilege, you go and pray to Lord and get a second janma and be born in my stomach and then you can play. So she kind of insults the boy and sends him off. And then the boy is very, very upset. Even though he's a five-year-old, he still has that feeling that I'm not able to, play with my father. My stepmother insulted me and he is full of anger and sorrow. And then he runs to his mother, Suniti. And Suniti by the time has already got the news because, the palace grapevine, she probably has her own servants or loyal servants who reports to her. So before even Dhruva comes to her, she knows what happened. And she is also saddened by the whole event. And then the boy cries to her and she also cries. And then they spend some time trying to console each other. And then she says, what can you do? It is, it is not the fault of others. She says very clearly, don't blame the others for what has happened to you. Very often you get into trouble because of your own action. This is the advice Suniti gives to Dhruva at this point. Yeah. So, you were unfortunately born to a, you know, misfortunate woman like me. No, you were unfortunate, I am misfortunate, and you were born to me. And your father is ashamed of calling me as his wife. Okay. So, you are not able to play like Uttaman is able to play with the father. Okay. And so, I think whatever Suruchi said is correct. I think you should go and pray to Lord Narayana and ask for a new Janma. And so, don't be jealous of your stepbrother. You go and pray to Lord Narayana. She gives him some advice. And she also glorifies Uttanapada. You know, she doesn't want Dhruva to carry some bad feelings about the father. So, she kind of defends Uttanapada and says, you know, your father is a very glorious person. He is the son of Manu. What is that? Swayambhu Manu. And Swayambhu Manu is a glorious person. He has conducted a lot of yagas with complete dakshina, and he himself a liberated person. So, your father, also knows the dharmas and all that. So, she kind of polishes the whole thing. And then she says, you go to the forest and you pray to Lord Narayana. And with this small advice, the boy leaves the palace. And then he is now going away. And he is still carrying that sorrow and, the whole incident is still very alive in his heart. And on the way, he meets Rishi Narada. So, Rishi Narada comes there. And he is kind of surprised that, you know, even though he's a small boy, he is able to really take things very seriously. And, normally children, they're very playfully minded. And they don't really listen to what people say and they don't take things to heart. They're always focused on, how to play and how to have fun and all that. But this boy has taken it very seriously. And so Narada is kind of, he's in wonderment. So he comes across the boy and stops him and asks him as though he doesn't know. You know, Narada knows what happened. But he's kind of asking, hey boy, where are you going? Why are you going alone? Okay, your face doesn't look like you're in a happy state. You look like you've been insulted by somebody. So what is the matter? So he's kind of provoking Dhruva to come out with the truth. So Dhruva says, hey Rishi, I'm surprised how you knew my mind just by looking at my face. You are such an educated person. So Dhruva praises Lord Narada. And he's asking, did you know my problem with your yoga powers, yogic powers? Because he knows that rishis have yogic powers. So, did you learn about my mental state through your yogic powers? So, he confesses to Narada, yes, I was insulted by my stepmother and she said like this. And she I went to my mother. My mother also told me to go and do tapas to Narayana. So, I am going to the forest and I am going to, do tapas to Lord Narayana. At this point, Narada says, you are not so old. You are not old enough to recognize praise and insult. So, actually, this is a very inappropriate reaction for your age. And he tries to give him some advice. He says, whatever effort you may do, unless your effort is complemented by divine grace, you will not get the result. So, if you wanted something and you didn't get it, you should understand that there is divine grace missing from there and you should take it in a sporting manner and then move on. So, don't take these things to heart. I think you should go back to your palace and be happy with your mother. Yeah? He gives him some advice. He's just testing the boy's determination just to see how strong his conviction is. Then this boy says, yes, you are right. You are a learned person, so what you are saying must be right. But unfortunately, I am an immature boy. I don't really appreciate what you are saying. So I am still convinced that I must go and, do the tapas in the forest. So you please tell me how I can go and do tapas. And please advise me where I should go, what I should do and all that. So he shows that he is not going to, you know, go back on whatever decision he took. And this is a general tactic, you know, whenever a guru comes across a sishya, the guru has to test the mettle of the sishya before actually giving him any, mantra upadesham or any other upadesham. And this story, a similar thing happens in the Kathopanishad also, where 8-year-old Najiketas goes to Yamaloka and waits for 3 days. And at the end of 3 days, he gets 3 boons from Yamaraja. And as a third boon, he asks for Brahma Vidya. And there, Yamadeva tests Nachiketas for a good 15-20 mantras in the Upanishad. He offers him everything in the world. He says, I'll give you this, I'll give you that. I'll give you the whole world as prize. He gives all kinds of, distractions, wealth and material possessions. And Nachiketas says, all that you keep yourself. I want Brahma Vidya. So, that kind of determination, even Dhruva is, displaying here. And then Narada says, okay, there is a place on the bank of Yamuna River. It is called Madhuvanam. And this Madhuvanam is probably the same as Vrindavanam, which we saw in the first day Gokarna story. So you go to Madhuvanam, and there you take a holy dip in that Yamuna River thrice a day. And then you use darbha grass and other materials for seating, and then you do pranayamam to clean your system and your internal mind and all that, and offer all the fresh fruits and vegetables that you get in the forest, and do a prayer of Lord Narayana, and he makes an upadesham also, mantropadesham. He gives this mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. That is the mantra Narada gives to Dhruva and says, you use this mantra and perform tapas towards Lord Narayana, and eventually you will be able to have darshan of Lord Narayana. That is the advice he gives, and then he moves to the palace. Narada then goes to the palace to check how Uttanapada is doing. So there he goes and sees that Uttanapada is all crestfallen and he's in a deep sorrow. And then as if he knows nothing, he's asking, what happened? You are looking very sorrowful, looking very sad. What happened? What is your problem? He's asking. Then he says, Uttanapada is very clever. He didn't say that he neglected the son. He says, my wife insulted my son. Because when the son came to sit on his lap, and when Suruchi made those statements, he was keeping quiet. And he was also just looking on. He didn't say anything to Dhruva. He didn't put Suruchi down. He didn't say anything to stop Suruchi. But now he is putting all the blame on Suruchi and says, my wife insulted the boy and the boy left the palace. So I am worried about my son's welfare. He has gone to the forest and the animals may kill him or he may come harm's way. I am worried about his safety. So I don't know what he is going to do. So all that, he tells to Narada. Then Narada says, don't worry. Your son will be taken care of by the Devas. He is in good hands and he will come back with lot of glory. I can tell you that he is going to have Lord Narayana Darshan and he will come back as a great person. So you don't have to worry about it. Okay. And then he goes off. Now we go back to Dhruva, who is on the way to the forest. He finally reaches the Madhuvanam on the banks of Yamuna. And then as instructed by Lord Narada, he begins his tapas. And in the first month, he is eating once in 3 days. The way he performs the tapas is given in detail. So in the first 1 month, he was eating whatever fruits he could get in the forest. And he ate those fruits once in 3 days and performed the tapas. And then after the first month is over, in the second month, he started eating once in 6 days. And in this once in 6 days also, he didn't eat the fruits. He started eating the leaves. He started eating the dried leaves and dried grass and all that. So he reduced his diet once in 6 days. And with that, he did the second month's tapas. And then in the third month, he started only drinking water and once in 9 days. So once in 9 days, he started just drinking water. Like that, he did 1 month of tapas. And then in the fourth month, he breathed once in 12 days. Okay, that means the kind of pranayamam and the prana shakti control he had on his breathing, that he was able to inhale and exhale once in 12 days, and like that he spent 1 month. Okay, and then in the 5th month, he stopped doing even that breathing, and he completely stopped his breathing and was in complete samadhi for the entire month. And in that 1 month samadhi, he had the image of Lord Narayana in his mind. His eyes were closed, and in his mind he was seeing only Lord Narayana. Now this image of Lord Narayana is something that Lord Narada had given to him at the time of the Upadesha itself. You know, when they meet on the way to the forest, Rishi Narada meets him. So he, at that time, he has given him some Dhyana Shloka. So in that Dhyana Shloka, there is a description of the Lord Narayana. And it goes like, you know, he is a very compassionate person. He's always got a very smiling face. And he's got a very beautiful nose and very broad eyebrows, you know. And he's got lovely cheeks. And he is the most beautiful among all the devas. And he looks young, okay. Then he's got very well-shaped body parts, you know, very proportionately sculpted body. And he's a very kind-hearted person. Whoever takes refuge in him, he'll take complete care of that person. He's full of compassion. He's full of love. And he's got that Srivatsa, which is a kind of mole on his chest. So the Srivatsa mole is one of the identification marks. And then his body will be black, you know, Neela Varna Shyama, you know, Neela Megha Shyama. So then he has Shankha, Chakra, Gada, and then a lotus in his hand. And then he'll have a kiritam, he'll have kundalam, he'll have different ornaments in his body. Then he'll have a silk, yellow silk, pitambaram dress. And then he'll have a kaustubha mala. So a lot of these descriptions are given. So the image that Dhruva has in his mind is the description of Lord Narayana as given in the Dhyana Shloka. Okay. Like this, he is performing tapas. And in this 5th month tapas, in addition to completely stopping his breath, he is also standing on one leg. And even on that one leg, he is not standing on the full foot. He's standing on the toe. So on the tip of the toe, he is standing on one leg and doing tapas. So that is the level of what we call Ugra tapas, we call in Sanskrit. That kind of a fierce tapas he is performing. And because of this fierceness of the tapas, the whole world, all the three lokas, experience a lot of heat. And this is something that we hear in a lot of different stories. You know, whenever somebody performs such an ugra tapas, such a fierce tapas, the whole world suffers. Okay, the whole world undergoes a lot of pain. And you can interpret it in different ways, but one way of looking at it is, this tapas this person is doing is like a project. Okay, let's say a metro project, because people from Bangalore and Chennai know the metro difficulties. So when a metro is being laid, the road is dug up all over the place and everybody goes through a lot of trouble. And so this tapas also is like a project. So this tapas is being done for some particular benefit. And in order to get the benefit, the road to getting the benefit is always full of troubles and problems. So that is one way of understanding. So this tapas that Dhruva is doing is for some larger good. And because of that initiative to bring the larger good into, you know, the world, people are being put to a lot of difficulty. So the whole, all the three worlds are going through a lot of heat and fire. And so the devas have become worried. The devas are not able to handle this at all. So the devas go and rush to Lord Vishnu and say, "Hey Vishnu, please protect us. This heat that we are, you know, receiving from Dhruva's tapas, we are not able to bear anymore, and we, all the three worlds are suffering. So you have to do something to stop this boy. So please do something." And Lord Vishnu says, don't worry, I will take care of it. You all go back to your home and all the devas go back. And then Bhagavan Vishnu decides to go and appear in front of Dhruva. So with that, the 8th chapter comes to an end. Now the 9th chapter begins. In the 9th chapter, Lord Vishnu gets on to his Garuda Vahanam and then goes to the place where Dhruva is performing his tapas. And the moment Lord Vishnu appears in front of Dhruva, that mental image that he was having in front of him vanishes. So because that mental image of Vishnu vanishes, he is wondering what happened, and he opens his eyes and then he sees Lord Vishnu right in front of him. And then he is overwhelmed with joy and he wants to pray to Lord and he wants to praise the Lord, but he doesn't know what to do. So he simply starts falling on the ground and he starts doing namaskaram to the Lord. And then Lord Vishnu understands that this boy Dhruva wants to sing a praise of him. So he touches the boy's two cheeks with his shankha, this panchajanyam. And then Dhruva gets all the wisdom that he needs to sing the Lord's praise. And then he rattles off a big prayer, and that is called Dhruvastuti. That Dhruvastuti is a very very nice set of shlokas. It's about 20-25 shlokas. And it can actually be used by us to perform our daily prayer or weekly prayer. So it's a very good set of shlokas. It is also a description of the Lord in so many words. And 9th chapter, no? Navamodhyayaha. It's not 20 or something. It's about 10 shlokas in all. 10 to 11 shlokas. But the shlokas are long. It is not the usual Anushtup Chanda. It is a longer Chanda. So I'll read one shloka for sample. Yo antah pravishya mama vacham imam prasuptam sanjeeva yatyakhila shakti dharaha swadhamna. That is one sentence, one line. Okay. Anyanscha hasta charana shravanatva gadina pranan namo bhagavate purushaya tubhyam. That's the second sentence. So that shloka is extra long shloka. And like that, there are about 12 shlokas totally. And these 12 shlokas, one can use, for by hearting and rendering as prayer. It takes about maybe 2-3 minutes after you have got it by heart. It's just a suggestion. This is in Skandha, 4th Skandha, 9th chapter, starting from shloka 6. If anybody has the original, otherwise I can share the original later. Yeah. So, in this set of shlokas, Dhruva praises Lord Narayana and he says that you have entered into my body and you have made me alive. You know, these prayers, if one reads these shlokas very carefully, these contain the essence of Vedanta. And in Bhagavatam, you have a lot of such places where there are prayers, and these prayers carry the Nirguna Brahmam and Saguna Brahma message simultaneously. And many of the Nirguna Brahmam portions are essentially Vedanta, essence of Vedanta. So he says, you, hey Lord Narayana, you have entered my body and given power to my hands and legs and ears and my pranan and my speech and all that. And you are such a great Paramapurusha that I bow before you. Okay. And he says, you are the master of the three gunas. You know, Maya, which is the material principle, is supposed to have three gunas. Sattva guna, rajoguna and tamoguna. And all of the creation is under the control of the three gunas. And Bhagavan is supposed to be above these three gunas. So he says, you are beyond the three gunas. You are not controlled by the three gunas, unlike the jivas, but you are the controller of the three gunas. Okay. And you have created this whole universe. And you have then entered this universe as the life principle. And you have activated the whole creation. You know, it is just the, in the first shloka, he talks about himself. In the second shloka, he extends that to the whole universe. Okay. And then he gives some examples, you know. When a piece of wood is burnt, the fire in that wood, it takes the shape of that wood. So whatever shape that wood has, the fire appears to have that shape. But really speaking, fire doesn't have a shape of its own. Similarly, you appear in the form of the world, but really speaking, you are beyond all forms and shapes. No, that is the example he gives. Then he says, even Brahmaji, who is supposed to be the creator of the world, created this world with the powers that you had given to him. You know, in Srishti, there are two Srishtis. The first Srishti is called Samashti Srishti. So, there is a Samashti Srishti that happens. When Vishnu creates Brahmaji, it is called Samashti Srishti. So, Vishnu basically creates Brahma and delegates all further creation to Brahmaji and goes back to rest. So, that is Samashti Srishti. And then the individual creation of animals and jivas and worlds and all that, that is called Vyashti Srishti. That Vyashti Srishti is what Brahmaji does. And this Vyashti Srishti that Brahmaji is doing, he is not doing independently on his own power, but he is using the power vested in him by Lord Vishnu. And he is simply using the delegated powers given by Lord Vishnu. So that is what Dhruva says. Okay. And then he says, the one who has realized you, or the one who has known you, is like someone who has woken up from sleep. You know? And this is again, an analogy or example that we give in Vedanta, that the jnani has woken up. You know, we are all supposed to be in sleep. No, this whole world is under the spell of Maya, and this spell of Maya is supposed to be like a sleep. And when we acquire jnanam or Brahmavidya or Brahmajnanam, we are supposed to wake up from this sleep and be awake at a higher level. So that higher awakening, Dhruva mentions here, one who has known you, one who has realized you, is like a woken up person. That means all others are sleeping. Okay? And then he says, Lord Narayana, you release us from the pains and throes of life and death. And this is again a principle that, you know, our Sanatana Dharma says, we are all kind of confined to or consigned to an endless cycle of birth and death. And unless we realize God, and unless we realize the true nature of God, we will continue to be in this birth and death cycle. And that release from birth and death cycle is called moksha or mukti. So here he says, you protect the jnanis by giving them liberation from the birth and death cycle. Okay? And he says, there are people who pray to you asking for small benefits. You know, there are many people who go to temple and ask for small things. And he says, such people who pray to you for small benefits are basically being deceived by your Maya. Because of the spell of your Maya, they are under that spell. So they are deceived, and they, instead of asking for the moksham, which is infinity, they are asking for very small benefits. It's like going to a Koteshwara and asking for 10 rupees, gift. So when you go to a Koteshwara, you might ask for a big amount, but if you go and ask for 10 rupees, that shows our smallness of the mind. So it is something like that. Okay. So he says, you are like a Kalpaka Vriksha. Kalpaka Vriksha is a tree mentioned in the Puranas, which is supposed to be in Devaloka. You stand under the tree and ask for anything, the tree will give you. That is Kalpaka Vriksha. Okay, and it has its own symbolism. We'll see if we can cover that. It is basically, Kalpaka Vriksha is nothing but the creativity of the human mind. You can put it in that way. So the creativity of the human mind is what is called Kalpaka Vriksha. Okay, then And here he glorifies the bhakti part. He says, the pleasure that the bhakta or the jnani gets from singing your glory and listening to your glorious stories, even moksha is not comparable. So this is actually a glorification, because moksha is supposed to be including everything. But here the Bhagavatam wants to glorify the bhakti part. So it says, by singing the glory of the Lord, you get a pleasure, get a happiness which is even much more than moksha. Okay, so we'll take it like that. Then, and he says, because the ordinary mortal is always living under the fear of death. You know, anytime death can come. Death doesn't serve as notice and come. It comes just all of a sudden and somebody is gone. So when everybody is, you know, under the sword of death, then how is it possible that, one can come and pray and ask for a small benefit? The first thing they should ask is liberation from death. But people don't do it. So Dhruva is lamenting. Okay? So, so he says, please bless me in such a way that I always get the company of those sadhus and those bhagavatas who are in your praise, who sing your praise all the time, and who are always in memory, in thinking about you. So I should be always in the company of such people. No, this is again a typical approach you see in Bhagavatam and other Puranas. They say that a person who serves the bhaktas is more glorious than the bhakta himself. So this is again, a way of glorifying the bhakta. And if you serve the bhakta, you are even more glorious. So, and that is why, this is a very common, approach taken in Vaishnava tradition. In the Vaishnava tradition, the adiyar kadiyar or something like that, there is a phrase there. So, one who serves the bhaktas, tondaradi podi alvar, there is an alvar. So, that tondaradi podi alvar actually means, tondar means the bhakta, adi podi means the dust on the feet. So, the alvar considers himself as the dust on the feet of a bhakta. So, he has got that kind of humility. So this is a glorification of the bhakta. So this is what Dhruva says, that I should always have the company of the bhagavatas who are singing your praise. So this is this whole thing goes on. No, this prayer goes on. As I said, it's about 12 shlokas. At the end of it, actually he came to the forest having a particular wish in mind. What actually triggered his trip to the forest was his father refused to play with him. And that was the thing he had in his mind. But when he had the darshan of Lord Vishnu, even that was forgotten. And he didn't even have the presence of mind to ask for moksha. Okay, even though he prayed all these 12 shlokas with all that glorification of the Lord, and he said that, you are capable of giving moksha, and anybody who asks you for anything less is, deceived person. All that philosophy he says, but at the end of this prayer, he doesn't ask for anything. He is kind of dumbstruck and he is not able to proceed further. So he chants these 12 shlokas and then keeps quiet. And then Lord Vishnu, on his own compassion, he grants him a set of boons. So this is not a boon that Dhruva had asked for, but this is a boon that Lord Vishnu, understanding the heart of Lord Dhruva, this boy Dhruva, he offers on his own. So now we see the boon given by Lord Vishnu to Dhruva. Okay. So he says, I fully appreciate all that you have said in your prayer. I know that this is how you think. Okay. So I will give you a boon which nobody else is able to get. So it's a very rare boon I am going to give you. Okay. And this position that I am going to give you is a very, very shining position, meaning it is a very attractive position for everybody. And even the entire cosmos will go around you. The whole cosmos will revolve around you. Okay? And it'll look like the whole world is, whole creation, not the world, the whole creation is revolving around you. Okay? And Dharma, Agni, Kashyapa, Shukra, Sapta Rishis, all the stars, all of them will go around you. You know, again, Dharma means all the karmas. Here the word Dharma doesn't mean the, Dharma Shastra, but all the karmas. And there is a reason why we say that. I'll come to that. Agni means here the Yajna. Okay? And Kashyapa and Shukra, Sapta Rishis are all referring to the stars. Because there are a lot of stars and constellations which are named after these rishis. So these are all reference to the stars. Basically, this is the position of the pole star. This padam that Vishnu is talking about is the position of the pole star. So he is going to be assigned as the pole star. And here a little bit of astronomy. You know, we all know that the earth has an axis around which it rotates. And then we know that the axis also has a slant of 23.5 degrees. You know, because of this 23.5 degree slant alone, we get the seasons like summer, winter and spring and autumn and all that. And in addition to this rotation around its own axis and revolution around the sun, the earth's axis also has a rotation like this, which is called the precession. You know, many of you would have played the top Bambaram in your young days. Yeah? And when you spin the top, initially this top is vertical and steady and straight. But once it starts losing some momentum, it will start going around like this. It won't be straight. It will be slightly standing and still going around like this. That is called precession. And the earth's axis actually goes through a precession. And this precession takes 26,000 years for completing one full circle. 26,000 years, once in 26,000 years, it completes a full circle. And here the Lord Vishnu says that you will have a reign or span of 26,000 years. So the Lord Vishnu here gives Dhruvan a boon saying that he will rule for 26,000 years. And we interpret it as a scientific fact mentioned in Bhagavatam, which says that the earth's axis, you know, has a precession of 26,000 years because every 100 or 150 years, the pole star will change. Because of this precession, the pole star will not be the same star all the time. Every 100, 150 years, it will point to a different star. And then it will go around like this and then come back to the same star again after 26,000 years. So that astronomical fact is given as a kind of coded message in this story. And Dhruva, the word Dhruva itself means steady, firm, that which doesn't move. Okay? And I think we can now go to the name of the wives and name of the sons and do a little bit of Tatparyam analysis. You know, the word Suruchi and Suniti are essentially our own two faculties. The king is like the individual. And Suniti is that part of our mind which can act according to ethics and morals and values. Niti. Niti means ethics and morals. And Ruchi means our sense pleasures. Suruchi is that tendency of the human being to go after sense pleasures and not bother about the morals and ethics. And Suniti is the focus on morals and ethics and dharma. And symbolically, the story says that when you are focused on Niti, you will have to let go of the Ruchi. And when you are focused on Ruchi, you will eventually let go of Niti at some point. So there is a dichotomy between Ruchi and Niti. And when you are dealing with Ruchi, you get pleasure. So the boy is Ananda. The boy's name is Ananda because when you deal with pleasurable matters, you get Ananda. And when you are dealing with Niti, your mind has to be very focused. Because if you get distracted a little, you will lose focus from the Niti. So the mind has to be Dhruva, focused. So the Dhruva is the result of being focused on Niti. Okay, so this is also a kind of interpretation we can take, that if you want to be focused on Niti, you will miss the sense pleasures. But because you miss sense pleasures, don't think it is inferior. Even though you may miss the sense pleasures, you achieve something much superior. And by following the path of Niti, because ultimately Dhruva gets moksha. Ultimately, Dhruva goes in the path of Niti and Bhakti and eventually has Lord Narayana's darshan and he gets moksha. And in the later part of the story, you will see that Ananda goes to the forest and gets killed. Okay, so indirectly the story says that if you are too focused on the sense pleasures and go after Ananda, you will have destruction. So that comes in the later part of the story. But we are still in the place where Vishnu is still giving granting boons to Dhruva. So Vishnu himself says that you go back to your father, he will receive you with full honors, and then you will be glorified. And then at one point he will crown you the king. And then he will go to forest and then your stepbrother will go to the forest and get killed. All this Vishnu himself says, okay, as a prophecy. And then because of the Ananda's death, Suruchi also will kill herself. And you will rule for 26,000 years. And after that, you will become, you will get this Dhruvapadam. Okay, you will reach a position which will have no destruction. The literal word that here says is, you will reach an indestructible position. Okay, you can take it as Dhruvapadam, you can take it as Moksham. Okay, that is left to interpretation. So with all these boons, the boy Dhruva returns to the palace. And then Uttanapada hears the news that Dhruva is returning to the palace. And then he goes with the whole family and entourage and welcomes Dhruva on the way back. You know, we have a tradition that when we know somebody is coming, we don't sit at home and wait for them to ring the bell. We actually go out and meet them halfway. So that tradition used to be there. I think nowadays we are not able to do it. And now the GPS brings them to the house, the different world we are living in. Yeah, but in those days, they would go at least at the entrance to the town, they will welcome the guest and bring him home. Okay, like that, they go and bring Dhruva, and then Dhruva comes to the palace and reunites with the father and mother, and they exchange the stories, and he narrates all the stories, how he had darshan of Lord Vishnu and all the boons he got and all that. And finally, the day comes when Dhruva is made the king. The king abdicates, Uttanapada abdicates the throne and goes to the forest. And as predicted by Lord Vishnu, this boy Ananda goes hunting in the forest and he gets killed there. Okay, now after he gets killed, Dhruva wants to take revenge on whoever killed him. So apparently one particular Asura king or a Gandharva king had killed him. Okay, so Punya Janaha. So the tribe which kills him is called Punya Janaha. Even though they did papam, they are called Punya Janaha. So, now something happens. This boy goes to the forest and he has a fight with somebody and he gets killed. And Dhruva doesn't know who exactly killed him. But then he goes and kind of destroys their whole town. And there is a huge war that happens between Dhruva on one side and the Punya Jana people on the other side. And they are also very powerful asuras. They know a lot of magic tricks and all that. So they do a lot of real fighting. They also do a lot of magical fighting. They scare Dhruva with a lot of magical stuff. And then somehow Dhruva overcomes all that and he defeats them. And at one point, the Manu himself comes and stops the war. The Manu, as in the Swayambhu Manu, who is the grandfather of Dhruva, he himself comes and stops the war and says, "Hey Dhruva, you are a very learned person. You have had direct darshan of Lord Vishnu himself. You are a very blessed soul and you know all the Dharma Shastras. you are not expected to, you know, get angry like this. And he gives him a long upadesha. He says that, you know, people don't die because of being killed by this one or that one. People die on the strength of their own karma. And if somebody kills them, it is only a tool because of which they get killed. So really speaking, what ends their life is their own karma. So your brother's karma had come to an end and he died. So don't blame anybody specifically for that. So you have already killed so many innocent people who had nothing to do with your brother's death. So you should stop this war. And he puts a stop to the war. He puts some good sense into Dhruva's head. And then after that, Dhruva, you know, falls at Swayambhu Manu's feet. And then he also does a prayer to Kubera, because apparently these people are Kubera's, proxy. So that whole place is supposed to be Kubera's territory. And so he does a prayer to Kubera and he pleases Kubera. And then Kubera says, okay, I've excused you. You can go back to your palace. And then Kubera, after getting permission from Kubera, Dhruva comes back to his palace and then he continues to rule the place. And as mentioned by Lord Vishnu, he rules for 26,000 years. And finally, he crowns his son and then leaves for Himalayas. And he performs a lot of tapas in Himalayas. And while he is performing tapas, the Vishnu Dutas come in a Vimana and then take him to Vaikuntha Loka. So with that, Dhruva goes to Vaikuntha and he becomes a liberated person. And with that, the story comes to an end. So this is Dhruva's story. Okay, now, you may just treat it as a story and move on. But there are a lot of small values that one can learn from this. As I said, you know, the very name Suruchi and Suniti, and Suruchi's son being Ananda and Suniti's son being Dhruva, you know, the significance of Ananda being the, pleasure derived from sense organs, and Dhruva being the focus on Niti and all that. That itself is a moral for normal human beings. So it tells us that, you know, don't go too much after sense pleasures, and also pay some attention to Dharma and Dharma Shastra and Bhakti and stuff like that. That will take you to the good path. If you follow too much on the, in the sense pleasure path, it will lead to spiritual destruction. You know, whenever we say destruction in these Puranas, it is not the real physical destruction, because everybody is supposed to die at some point. So physical destruction is always there. When we say destruction in the Puranas, it is more of the spiritual destruction, because once a person has a spiritual fall, the recovery from the spiritual fall is much more difficult to make up for. Now, if you lose some money here and there, you can make up the money in some form or the other later on. But spiritual downfall, which means, a downfall in our values, a downfall in our character, all these things are very difficult to bring back. It takes several janmas for somebody who has gone through a spiritual downfall to recover all that, spiritual level that he had earlier attained. So it is always mentioned in our Puranas that all the tapas and all the upavasas and all the other, rigor that the religious life tells us, it is not for our physical welfare. It is more to make sure that we have a good set of values that will take us across the samsara sagara and help us make spiritual progress. So whether we talk about going to the temples and doing regular pujas at home, or chanting stotras, or doing Gayatri Japa Mantra, whatever it is, any small practice that we are encouraged to follow is to make sure that at least we don't have a fall. We may not have progress, but at least maintain whatever spiritual maturity that we have attained and make sure that it doesn't come down. It may go up in a very gradual manner, but make sure it doesn't come down. That is the whole focus of all our Puranas and all our scriptural teachings. So this theme will actually be found in many stories in Bhagavatam. You know, more than acquiring knowledge, the Bhagavatam focuses on learning the glories of the Lord and singing the praise of the Lord and using the stories as a form of, discussing with each other. Instead of, when two or three people meet, instead of talking about this and that in gossip form, if we can get into the habit of discussing these divine glories and divine aspects of God and all that, that itself will set the tone for spiritual progress. So that is the whole idea of having all these stories. And there is one more story called Ajamilopakhyanam. There also the theme is similar. In the Shastras, one thing is very clearly said. You will have a next Janma unless you have acquired Jnanam in that Janma and you have become a Jnani. Jnanam as in Brahma Jnanam. Okay? Until you have become a Brahma Jnani, there is no way you can avoid the next Janma. And what will be your next Janma? That is determined predominantly by your karma phalam. No, we all have something called Sanchita Karma. We have been going through millions and millions of Janma until this Janma. Okay? And in all these millions and millions of Janma, we have done so much of karmam, and all those karma phalams have accumulated and they are all in one big bundle. That is, big bundle is called Sanchita Karma. And a very small portion of that Sanchita Karma becomes ready for enjoyment or experience in one given Janma. Because every karma has its own, what you call, gestation period. Not every karma will give the benefit or result immediately or in a fixed time. It is like having multiple recurring deposits with different maturity dates. You can have one recurring deposit with 1 year maturity, another with 5 year maturity, another with 15 year maturity, another with 45 years maturity. And imagine your Sanchita Karma bundle to be a huge bundle of such recurring deposits which have different maturity dates. And at any given point of time, a small set of those karmas are maturing and ready to give their power or benefit to you. And they may be good results or they may be bad results. And depending on that karma bundle which is maturing, that is called Prarabdha Karma. So it is a subset of Sanchita Karma, and this Prarabdha Karma is what triggers the next Janma. This is the major factor. There is a minor factor that influences your next Janma, and that is the thought in your mind at the exact moment when your prana leaves your body. The thought that the person carries at the time of death has a major influence on what kind of Janma you will get in the next Janma. Okay, and to illustrate this, there are a lot of stories in Bhagavatam itself. There is a story of Jadabharata, which is very famous, and I am not sure if Jadabharata story is included in the syllabus. And so Ajamilopakhyanam is one such story. Give that in a very brief 5-10 minutes summary. So Ajamila is a normal human being. He is a family man. He's got number of children, and he's got all kinds of vices. He's not some holy kind of guy who does puja every day and all that. He doesn't even think of God. He is a very worldly man, and he's got a lot of children. And the last of those children, the son, he names him Narayana. So the last boy, his name is Narayana. And he is a very favorite son of this Ajamila. And then this Ajamila is an old man. He is, in old age, he becomes sick and he's about to die. And just at the moment of his death, he is seeing the Yamakinkaras coming. The Yamas, Dutas, who have come to take his life away. And they appear in a very gruesome kind of a Bhayankara form. And he is terrified of these Yamadutas. And being the favorite son, he calls out his son Narayana. Hey, Narayana, Narayana, he calls. Okay, just because the son is his favorite son. Because he calls out Narayana, Narayana, immediately Vaikuntha sends two Narayana Dutas, and they fight with these Yamadutas and take this man to Vaikuntha. Okay? So even though this fellow was a total rascal all his life, just because at the very last minute he remembered Narayana, Narayana Dutas come and pick him up and go to Vaikuntha. And then the Yamadutas have a big problem with this. They go and tell Chitragupta and Yama, how is this possible? This fellow was meant to suffer from Naraka because of all the bad things he done all his life. And you tell me, how is it that the Narayana Dutas are able to snatch this man from me and take him off? Is this not a violation of law? So there is a court case going on between Narayana Dutas and Yamadutas. And then Yama comes and says, what the Narayana Dutas have done is right. There is an exception in some clause XYZ. And because of that, if you remember Lord Narayana at the end of the life, you become liberated. Okay. Now people can easily say, fine, I'll do all the akramam and all the, all the things in my life, and at the last minute I'll remember Narayana. You can say that. But the problem is, nobody knows when his last minute will come. Okay, Yama doesn't send any advance notice to take your life off. People die within 1 second's notice. You don't even know you're dying. Okay, so the whole idea is, if you practice thinking of the Lord all through your life, and if you practice that strongly enough and good enough to carry the thought even in your toughest moments, most turbulent moments, if you can remember the Lord and be steady in your mind that the Lord will save me, that practice ensures you that at the time of your departure from the body, there is a very high probability. Even there, it is not 100% certainty. You still have Heisenberg's uncertainty principle acting there. So there is a high probability that you will think of the God and then you will be saved. That is the whole idea. So this Ajamalopakhyanam is not to be taken as a license to do whatever we want all through our life, but it is to tell us that even for such hopeless cases, there is some hope available. And so let us promote ourselves in the ladder and not try to be at Ajamila's level. That is the whole idea. Okay? So I think with this, I have covered whatever I had planned to cover for today. So if there are any questions, I'll be happy to take. Yes, sir. See, every action, our Dharma Shastra very clearly say that whatever action we perform in our Janma, and this is particularly for Manushya Janma. No, I must make it very clear. Animals don't have the what is called Agami Karma. Because animals don't perform their action out of free will. Okay? So it is for the human beings who perform action out of our free will. Whatever you do with the expectation of something in return, those karmas are called kamya karma. Okay? And the time taken for the kamya karma to fructify and give you the result is not definite. It is a stochastic process. Okay? It may give you benefit in 2 years, it may give you benefit in 2 janmas or 20 janmas. But whenever that benefit comes, you have to experience it. Whatever you do will not go waste. That is the theory. Yeah? So anything that you do, whether it is good or bad, it will come back to you. And when it comes back to you, it will come only back to you only. It won't hit somebody else. Yeah? So, that means in every Janma, you do so many actions. And in some cases, you may get the benefit immediately. And what we say is, even the karma, the benefit or the result it gives, some of it can be visible, some of it can be invisible. The same karma, some of the benefit can be visible and some of it can be invisible. I'll give you an example. Let's say you have some food, leftover food, and you go and give it to some beggar who's hungry. So you're basically doing some kind of annadanam. Okay? Annadanam, not with the intention of annadanam, but you had some leftover food, you want to give it to somebody who will eat it, you give it. So the beggar receives it and eats it and he feels happy and his stomach is full. Okay. And you probably become a little happy because of that. Okay. these are the visible results of your karma. Okay, but the invisible result, what the Shastra says, that you acquire some punyam because of that. You know, you could have thrown that food anywhere, but you didn't do that. Out of your free will, you went and gave it to somebody who's hungry. So in that sense, you did something good, so you get some punyam also. Okay, so we are not talking about the visible result that you get immediately. Even some invisible result may be associated with the visible results. You know, on the other side, let's say you commit some crime. Okay, you commit some crime, some small crime. You know, it may be even jumping the red light and going off. Okay, you may get away with no fine also. Okay, because there is no camera there, nobody sees you, and you somehow get away with it. But there may be 10 people watching you do that, and your action could be a motivation for those 10 more guys to jump the red light the next time. So in that sense, you have caused the papam because you have created more disorder in the society. So that is also an invisible result of your action. Even though you may not get visible punishment immediately, you have caused a few others to commit an act of, this kind of a petty thing, and you have caused more turbulence or whatever in thermodynamics we call entropy, you have created more disorder in the system. Okay, so every act of yours has certain result which will come to you in the future. Okay, so all of us have gone through millions and millions and countless number of janmas in the past. This is not our first janma. This is true for everybody in this room and everybody in this world. Okay. So, since all of us have gone through so many janmas, we have done so much of karma in all those janmas. And some of them we have already, gone through all the results, and some of them are waiting for us. That cumulative bundle is called Sanchita Karma. Okay? And as I said, not everything matures at the same time. Some of them, a very small portion matures, and depending on what kind of karma that matures, you may get an animal body, you may get a plant body, you may get a human body, you may be born in a good place like Germany, you may be born in Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan, God knows. Okay, so you can be put through all kinds of difficulties. Yeah. So depending on your prarabdha karma, that small maturing thing is called prarabdha karma. And then in that janma, you do more karma, right? That will come in the future. That is called agami karma. And at the end of your janma, that agami karma gets added back to the sanchita karma. It's like a feedback loop. So there is a sanchita bundle, a small amount gives rise to prarabdha. And during the exhaustion of prarabdha, you create new agami karma. And at the end of the janma, that agami accumulated in that janma gets added back to sanchita, and this cycle continues. You just keep going on and on and on.
When one
soul
reaches moksha, that time,
It is
something like the karma,
that
bundle is gone, or the good and bad karma neutralizes, or...
Yeah, so what the Shastra says is that, in order to become liberated, you need to realize God. Okay? Now, different systems talk about it in different ways. Okay? I won't get into that. In one system... The question was, what happens when you become liberated? Do the karmas cancel out or something? Okay. So, what the Shastras say, once you have realized God, the entire Sanchita bundle gets burnt off. The whole Sanchita thing is destroyed completely. There is nothing left. So, there is no starting balance. Okay? And you have to go through the prarabdha. There is no escaping. Because prarabdha is something that has been set in motion. So whatever is part of the prarabdha bundle, you have to go through it. Okay? If it means that, you step on a mine and lose a leg or whatever, it has to happen. Okay? But from that point, when you realize God, you don't create fresh agami. So because you don't create fresh agami, there is nothing that gets added to the Sanchita bundle. Sanchita bundle is completely destroyed. So all that you have to deal with is your prarabdha. So if your prarabdha says you got to live for another 50 years, you live 50 years. If it says you want to live for another 5 days, you live for 5 days. So, but that prarabdha is what governs the rest of your life.
Start relating the goal and the prarabdha karma is still there, but there is still some left prarabdha karma that will happen in the same janma or...
Prarabdha karma is limited to only one janma. Prarabdha means one janma. Okay, that bundle you have to clear off in one janma. That is your opening balance for that janma. And that has to become zero. If you carry any carry forward, that goes to agami karma and gets added back. Yeah. So, like he says, it's an operating account. And your sanchita karma is like your balance sheet. If there are any financial guys here, they'll understand. Sanchita karma is like balance sheet and your prarabdha karma is like your operating account. Yeah.
Millions of janmas already gone. Most likely millions of janmas yet to come. Is there hope?
Millions of janmas yet to come is up to you. It is up to you. You know, in Viveka Chudamani, there is a beautiful shloka which says that this human janma is a rare janma. In Viveka Chudamani, Shankaracharya says there are 72 lakh species on this earth. 72 lakh species. And you could have been born as any one of those 72 lakh species. But you are now born as a human being. That means it is the probability of anybody being born as a human being is 1 in 72 lakh. That is how many zeros before the first significant digit. Okay, 72 lakh zeros almost. Okay. Durlabham trayam evaitat devanugraha hetukam manushyatvam mumukshutvam mahapurusha samshraya. That's the shloka. Okay. It says there are three things which are very, very rare to get. The first is the human birth itself. Because you escaped 71 lakh something something 999 species and caught this one human birth like that. So you have already cleared that first hurdle. You have acquired manushyatvam. The second rare thing is for the human beings to think of moksha itself. Mumukshutvam means to put moksha somewhere on your list of to-dos. All of us have a long list of to-dos. Okay. You may have 600 items or 800 items in your to-do list. And if you examine your to-do list, and if you find that moksha is there on some level, even if it may be the 601st item on your to-do list, then you have some hope. Okay. Because what the Shastras say is that to get moksha into your list of to-dos itself is a big effort. But the moment moksha enters your to-do list, something beautiful happens. Slowly, the priority for moksha gets promoted quickly. And very soon, you will start seeing that it is somewhere at the top. Earlier, it was some item number 601 in your list. And slowly, it became 500, 400, 300, 200, then 50, 40, 30... 9, 8, 5, 4, 3, and at one point you will find that moksha is number one on your list. It happens. If that moksha as an entry was a serious entry, really very consciously made entry, it will promote itself and come to the top of the ladder and it will become item number one. And once it becomes item number one, slowly the list will start shrinking. You will no longer have 600 items in your list. The list itself will start shrinking and you will only have one or two things left. And then all your energy and focus will be on how do I become liberated? How do I get moksha? That will become a burning quest in you. That is what the Shastras say. So the first thing is to put moksham somewhere in that list. Okay? Then, Mahapurusha Samshraya. Because in the Advaita school at least, moksha can be got only by acquiring Brahma Jnanam through the study of Shastras. And that study of Shastras you cannot do independently. You have to take the guidance of a guru. So, for moksha, you need a guru, a living guru who can teach you Shastras, the Upanishads. And that association with a learned traditional guru is here called Mahapurusha Samshraya. So, three things, Durlabham, Trayam Evaitat, Deva Anugraha Hetukam. You need a lot of punyam, he says. Deva Anugraha Hetukam means you need a lot of punyam to get these three things in one combination. See, we have a lot of human beings in this world, but how many of them really have moksha on their list? That itself shrinks the list. You know, the number of people who have moksha is a very small list. And among those also, those who have clarity that I need a guru to get moksha, that clarity is missing from most people. A lot of people think that they can grab a book from here and there and read on their own and become jnani and become moksha. No, mukta purusha. That's not possible. You do need a guru. And the recognition that I need a guru for moksha is also missing from those people who may have moksha on their list. So to get a guru, you first have to seek a guru. Okay, you go seeking a guru, and then the shastras also say that when the student is ready, the guru appears. When the student is ready, the guru appears. So he comes from out of nowhere. Okay, so these three things, when they come together in a person, then he is on the right path. If not in this janma, definitely next janma, he is going to get moksha. You don't have to talk about million janmas from now.
So I just add one more thing to that. That we are going to have this sattaham announced to so many people. Every session, we have only a few people coming. So for those few people to come, the prarabdham is good. So you definitely have to.
but the second next agenda should not be a human. It can be anything.
Yeah. See, that's what the shastras say. No, once you have come in this spiritual, path, the karmas kind of adjust themselves to give you a favorable condition. In the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, there are some shlokas. Arjuna asks exactly this question. You know, in the 6th chapter, from the 37th shloka or somewhere, 7th shloka, Lord Krishna explains. He says, if you have started on the spiritual journey in this janma, but for whatever reasons, you are not able to complete your spiritual, project, acquire jnanam and acquire moksha, Arjuna asks, do I have to start all over again from my next janma? Do I have to start from zero? That is the question Arjuna asks. And Lord Krishna says, no. If you have started on this spiritual path, and for whatever reasons, your current janma comes to an abrupt end, without you reaching that jnanam, your next janma will be in such a way that conditions for you to continue your spiritual journey from the exact point where you left off in the previous janma, that will be available to you. Either you will be born in a family of Brahmajnani scholars where the father himself will teach the son Brahmajnanam, or you will be born in a family of culture, Vedic culture, where the family values this Vedic teaching and moksham and all that, and you will get into that groove helplessly, he says. In the shloka, Lord Krishna says, you will get into that groove helplessly. Avashena is the word Krishna uses. I am not able to remember the exact shlokas now, but it is in the Bhagavad Gita 6th chapter, shlokas 37 onwards. Asamshayam Mahabaho Mano Durnigriham Chalam Abhyasena Kaunte Vairagina Jikrise Prap Yoga Samsiddhim Kam Gattim Krishna Gachati Kachino Abhi Vibhrashta Chinna Brahmanashati Apratishto Mahabaho Vimuro Brahmanapati Etanme Samshayam Krishna Chetumashina Seshata Todaniha Samshaya Siasi Chetana Vipati Partha Naiveha Namutra Vinashastasya Vidyate Nahi Kalyana Krati Kachati Durgatim Tata Gachati. He says, once you have started on this holy spiritual path, you will not reach a durgati. Durgatim tata na gachati. Durgatim partha naivehanamutra vinashasthasyavidyate. Nahi kalyanakriti kashchiti. Durgatim tata gachati. Prapya punyakritam lokan uchitva shashvati samaha. Shuchinam shrimatam gehe yoga bhrashto vijayate. He gives a name to that person. He calls him a yoga bhrashta. Yoga bhrashta is a one whose spiritual journey has been broken. Bhrashtam means broken. So Yoga Bhrashta is the name he gives to that yogi whose journey is stopped halfway. Yoga Bhrashta becomes born in a family of values where Vedic culture is valued and where the parents are able to teach the boy the appropriate Vedic principles. Okay? Shuchinam Srimatam Gehe Yoga Bhrashto Bijayate Athava Yoginam Eva Kule Bhavati Dhimatam Etadhi Durlabhataram Loke Janma Yididrisham. Okay? And then he says, Tatra Tam Buddhi Sanyogam Labhate Paurva Dehikam Yatate Tato Bhuyaha Samsiddho Kurunandana. There in that Janma, he begins exactly where he left off. Tatra Tam Buddhi Sanyogam. Paurva Dehikam means whatever he had in his previous body. So wherever he left off in his previous body, from there he will begin as if he just got up from sleep from the previous day. So that is the level of confidence Lord Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita, that once you have started on the spiritual path, don't worry about your progress. The Lord will take care of your progress. The Lord is more concerned that you become a jnani and become a moksha than you yourself being concerned. So the Lord will create conditions for you to become a mukta purusha. That is the kind of guarantee Lord Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita. Okay? What more guarantee can you have? Okay? Any question? Any more?
Yes.
Anyone?
I just have something. I think this is really very beautiful again, what we heard today. So another thing I wanted is this Bhagavatam is pretty awesome in terms of getting our values, learning more about values, becoming aware of it. But the thing is, I don't know whether it's too early to ask this, how are we going to actually, it'll be nice to apply something practically, have some sort of a format where we have opportunities to continue, discussing or continue introspecting these points.
Okay.
And I hope this is never finished, Bhagavatam,
Okay. So, this is a question from Shobha on the conference call. So, what she says is, it's very useful that Bhagavatam gives us all these values and, the objectives that we have to achieve in terms of moksha and all that. And it gives us a lot of values to practice. But where is it given the method or procedure to implement all these things and how to practice all these things? That's a question from Shobha. So this is, my answer. I'm not sure if anywhere in the Bhagavatam it is said in so many words, but this is the answer I'm giving based on what I have learned from my guru. See, whatever you do, it begins with a thought. In the earlier class also I said that we have to watch our thoughts, because the thoughts become words and words become actions. And action becomes habit, and habit becomes our destiny ultimately. Habit becomes character, character becomes destiny. So, as I said, the moment you have these values on your radar and you really want to incorporate these values in your day-to-day life, you will find a way, because it is the desire that prompts all of us to take action in a particular direction. And as long as you develop a strong desire to put these values into action, you will find your own way. There is no single silver rule or golden rule that applies to everybody. Everybody has to find their own way of how to put these things into practice. And what may be suitable for you may not be suitable to somebody else. So the first thing is to put these values on your desirable quality list, assuming that somebody has such a list. We see a lot of videos on change management, and everybody talks about how to bring about change, and even the great coaches of the world, they talk about bringing about change in one's own habits and character and all that. Changing one's own way of behavior is a very difficult thing. And even if you incorporate, say, one value in a matter of 3 to 4 years and put it completely to practice, you've achieved a lot. Okay, so it doesn't have to be that you put all the values into practice in one lifetime. That may or may not be possible. But you begin with one value and take any one value that you think is the most appropriate for your situation. And then you see how you can, bring it into your day-to-day life, and that itself will tell you what you can do next.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you. That makes sense.
Okay. Anybody else?
Any new habit
if you want to follow, if you diligently follow it for 48 days, there is a very good chance that you will continue to do it on the 49th day also. Yeah, it is anything. Developing a new habit, a new good habit, letting go of a bad habit, anything. All of that takes time. Okay. No more questions? You have a question? Correct. See, there is something called a general rule and there is something called exceptions. Okay, so you are probably talking about exceptions. The general rule is that animals don't have a free will. Okay, the general rule is that the animals don't have a free will. But if you look at Jadabharata's story, Jadabharata is a very mature jnani who unfortunately slips into developing an affection for a deer. And this affection for the deer, he carries right up to the moment of his death. So even though he was a jnani, he was a very learned person, and he was a king who left his kingdom and went to the forest to perform tapasya, but there he comes across this small deer calf and develops an affection towards it. And then when he dies, he is remembering only the deer. Because of that, he becomes born as a deer in the next janma. Okay, now here is the case of an evolved soul getting trapped in the body of a deer. Okay, so this is an exceptional case. So the soul has the knowledge that I am a jnani, that I slipped from my practice and I became a deer. So the deer is actually regretting in that janma. What did I do? Why did I do all this? I could have become a liberated person. Now I am stuck in this body of a deer. And then it doesn't stop there. After the deer janma, he becomes born as another shudra or something. And then in that janma, he gets insulted by a lot of people. And finally, he becomes born as a brahmana. So we will see the Jadabharata story, if possible, in one of these next classes. And so it's actually a very good lesson to show how you can be a spiritually evolved person and still slip from your practice and get into trouble. No, it's a very good example. So the kind of cases you are talking about are probably the exceptions, where they had some kind of a vasana in the previous janma, which is a good vasana, which is making them do things which they are not normally allowed to do. Okay? But coming to the Devas case, the Devas are supposed to be full of sattva guna, and so whatever they do, it is always in alignment with dharma. They will not do anything against dharma. They will not have a free will to do anything against dharma. So they are a very special category of people. And asuras, I agree, have a free will, because they do go about creating a lot of problems and they commit a lot of crimes. And even there, that is partly programmed in them, because they are full of tamoguna. So asuras by nature are like that. Okay, but then we also see the case of Prahlada, where even though he is born as an asura, he develops a lot of bhakti to Vishnu, and he eventually becomes the most favorite bhakta for Vishnu. So you have exceptions on both sides. Okay, so these are all general rules and then exceptional rules, exceptional cases.
So just one little question. I think you answered it, but I just still want to be sure. So are we saying that once we take a human birth, then the chances that you would take an animal birth is not, won't mostly happen unless, like this exceptional story you shared. Is this correct?
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. So what she's saying is it the case that once you have acquired a human birth, the chances of you getting an animal birth in the next janma are reduced? That's not the case at all. The next janma, as I said, is dependent on two specific things. One, what kind of prarabdha karma is ready and waiting for you at the end of this janma. And to some extent, what kind of a thoughts do you carry at that exact moment when you leave the body. These two are the factors. Okay? So, even though you might have done a lot of good deeds during all your janma, if due to some bad luck or chance, you end up having some kind of thought which is not exactly divine or whatever, then you could slip into a different kind of janma. Let's say, nowadays a lot of people have pet dogs and pet cats. And so if you are very attached to your pet dog or pet cat, you may be thinking of your dog when you die. And that is a risk. Yeah? I mean, I have nothing against dogs. Huh? Don't mistake me. But
no.
Yeah, it's a bonding. Yeah, it's emotional bonding. There is one story where in the Bhagavatam itself, there is a Puranjanopakhyanam where there is a man and at the time of death, he is worried about his wife. How will my wife, survive after I die? And then the next janma, he is born as a woman. Okay, so this theme is consistently repeated in Bhagavatam and other Puranas. So the thought that you carry at the last moment of your life plays a very, very, very big role. And that is the reason all the Shastras extol you to, think of the Lord all the time, wherever possible, whenever possible.
So if you take the last part, sorry, I just want to understand this a little better. So if you take this last minute thought away, right? I mean, there were two factors, last minute thought away. Can the prarabdha karma itself be so strong that you could be born as an animal?
Maybe. See, the question again, Shobha continues with her question. So she says, if you take this last minute thought away, is there a chance that prarabdha karma pushes you into an animal life? Very much possible. See, the Shastras do not give a clear cut, this way or that way answer. It says your prarabdha karma is not known to you. It is known only to the Lord. And your karmas, if they turn out to be lucky for you, you will get a favorable prarabdha karma in the next janma and you have a favorable janma. If, God forbid, you don't have a favorable prarabdha karma, then you will get into a miserable life next janma. The Shastras don't give you any guarantee. There is no, fallback clause which will, indemnify you from all future damages. Nothing like that. There is no indemnification clause.
Only spirituality starts from where you left off from the last.
That is assuming that you actually started off in the spiritual journey and did some bhakti and did some puja, upasana and all that. Yeah?
It's not necessarily from that, just minus one karma. I mean,
yeah.
Minus one
karma. You had a question, Sridhar.
Yeah.
Is there any explanation in the Shastra on why the human population is growing? Why so many people get lucky to be human?
See, the number of jivas in this whole cosmos is infinite. Infinite. Infinite means you can't put a number to it. It is infinite. And there are so many jivas who are still hibernating and waiting for some other yuga in which to be born. Okay. And so why the human population increases, why the human population decreases, these are all questions which cannot be answered like that. It's all, again, so many people have their karmas that they have to come together. You know, what we say is, a plane crash happens or a train accident happens. Okay, in a plane crash, 500, 600 people are there. In a train accident, maybe 1,000 people are there. Even though the accident is the same, not everybody is injured to the same extent. Some people die. Some people escape with minor scratches in a train accident. It's very rare that in a plane crash somebody survives. I haven't really come across a plane crash where somebody survived. Okay? Generally, plane crashes result in everybody getting killed. But there may be cases where there is a plane crash and nobody dies also. I saw a video where the pilot very cleverly lands on a river. It happened in Washington or somewhere.
Yes, US.
Yeah, US, it happened somewhere. So, guy, after takeoff, he sees that both the engines have failed and he's just sliding. And with a great presence of mind, he lands on the river and then ships come and rescue everybody. Okay, so these things can happen. So, in that instance, when 300, 500 people's lives are, at the same point, they all have a certain prarabdha karma which has brought them together. So how is it that they all came to that particular train or particular plane, suffered that fate, even though they might have come from different destinations? Their karma brought them together. There is no other explanation. Okay, similarly, if all of us have come into this world at a particular given time, it's only, you can call it divine grace or divine curse, whichever way, if it's a good life, it's a divine grace. If it's a bad life, it's divine curse. So, karma. Ultimately, it's a neutral word, karma. Because we say that without the theory of karma, you really cannot explain the kind of differences in status, differences and up and downs that people go through in life. You cannot explain it otherwise. Because what you do in a given life doesn't answer everything that happens to you. Yeah? Okay.
Matuji, I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Can I ask? Are we running?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. So actually, my question is on moksha. So moksha, mukti. Yeah. So that is attained when we actually give up our material desires. So when we see Dhruva, he has done a lot of suffering for a long time. And he's achieved that. So my question is, in our life, day-to-day life, is it like moksha means that when we completely be cut off from material desires, or how is it like in a day-to-day family life? Is it so, can we define moksha, mukti like that?
Defining moksha, mukti is out of scope for this session. So this is a question from Vijaya. Okay, so she says she wants to understand the true nature of moksha, and her question is: Dhruva performed a lot of tapas and he gave up material desires, and then he attained moksha. So does it mean that we also have to give up our family and all our desires and go to some forest for moksha? So that is not the case. Our Shastras say that a Grihastha can attain moksha by following his dharma. Okay, so this is a very involved question. It requires a very very elaborate answer. It cannot be given in 5 minutes or 15 minutes. And we can have it offline or we can have it separately in another class. But the fact is, you can be in the family, you can take care of your kids and husband and other family duties and still qualify for moksha. That is possible. There are methods to do it, and a lot of people have done it.
Okay. Okay.
You don't have to leave everything and go to the forest.
Probably we can discuss another session.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Okay.
So if there are no more questions, can we close? Or anybody from the conference bridge? Over? Okay. Om Purnamadaha. पूर्णमिदं
पूर्णमिदं
पूर्णात् पूर्णमुदच्यते
पूर्णात्
पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेवावशिष्यते सर्वेषां स्वस्तिर्भवतु सर्वेषां शान्तिर्भवतु सर्वेषां पूर्णं भवतु सर्वेषां मङ्गलं भवतु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः
ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः।